So where do we start from?
Okay.
Okay.
So I go last.
The people who are gonna graduate first.
Okay. So I have mainly two simple ideas. The first one was, and we already discussed this, was partition the cache of the operating system among all the processes, right? So if we have, I don't know, 10 processes running, we take all the memory that we have and we partition the cache between those 10. And the idea is that they don't, if for instance one process is doing sequential reading or something like that, doesn't waste all the cache and making all the processes we have some locality, you know, have misses.
You're talking about cache, memory cache? Or
memory cache.
Okay.
Memory cache. Okay. This also works for CPU cache, but I wanted to do it for memory, for, you know, source cache. It turns out that it already exists, some of it, but I was interested, so I just
wanted to. So what we're saying is that reserving the cache for
process. Reserving a portion of the cache for every process will bring down the heat ratio, the miss ratio overall, right? I mean, will increase for probably separate processes, but overall it will bring it down.
I think that you need a different example to motivate, right? Because the sequential example is easily addressed with as a special case.
Right.
So if I detect sequentiality, I don't cache it, right?
Right, right.
And so,
yeah, it's true. I mean,
so a different example would to motivate this would be nicer.
Okay. Yeah, the other thing I wanted to check is if this can somehow be useful for power saving.
Hmm.
And the only thing I found was there is one word for
power saving.
I don't know, because you're reducing the miss rate, right? So if you have less,
so well, first of all, it's not clear to me that you're reducing the miss rate. Because let's say that, I mean, you have one process that uses 80% of the cache and the other 20%.
Right.
But that process is more memory intensive and the other process is CPU intensive.
Right.
So, I mean, would this...
But this partition is dynamic. It's not like you will divide exactly the same amount for everybody, but you will divide, you will do the partition dynamically depending on how much each process needs.
And by the way, that's related to my idea, which I guess I could talk right now about, is that, I mean, when you mix workloads in the same cache, you have this kind of wastage, and I've seen that experimentally for lots of replacement algorithms and lots of traces, and I cannot explain it, we cannot explain, but it happens. So the other way of using this is that if you separate these workloads and give them as caches individually, you have less miss, you don't have this wastage anymore. And I want to model it, if you want to use Freeman.
Right. I think coming up with a stronger motivation beyond just saying that, okay, we observed this happens, right?
Yeah.
To say why it happens and even for a solution to appear that it actually addresses the problem, you have to know what the problem is, right? Or where the origin of the problem is.
Yeah.
So the problem is the cache mixing is performance degradation?
Yes.
Okay,
because
so it's not power saving.
Well, at the end, it's power saving, but how? Because more cycles, more power. More cycles, more time.
Not only that, but if you reduce the in the case of the storage, if you reduce the misses, you are giving a bigger window of time where the disk can turn up, for instance. Right.
Indirect saving.
Yeah,
to power.
I think that's a secondary and like really remotely connected effect.
Mm-hmm.
The way I see it, I mean, you are largely motivating performance here. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't immediately see how you can use it for power saving.
Well, I found one paper where they use it for power saving actually, and the way it works is that I guess their configuration was they have a bunch of disks, and they have a single cache for all disks. So I don't remember well, but basically they partition that cash somehow. And I don't know, probably...
Well, I'm sure there may be some power benefits, but I think that's not the primary goal with what you're doing, right?
No, it's not. But what I'm saying is that with the idea of partitioning cash, you can also somehow partition the cash so that you can save power. For instance, if you dedicate most of the cash to one disk, you can turn off that disk because you
yeah.
Right.
So that is a different kind
it's
of goal.
It's a different kind of goal, but
yeah.
It's still partitioning.
I see.
And I think nowadays it's easier to save power saving than save that performance. Right?
Oh, no. No?
No,
it's always better to save performance.
Yeah.
So
I think performance is, there was a time, like maybe 1 or 2 years, where power was really cool.
Like this, yeah. But
yeah.
Not anymore.
I don't think so.
So
I think it's gone.
You're
what you're saying is that you're trying to partition the cash to avoid pollution, to less local burns, process with less locality, to pollute the process with more locality.
Yeah.
Right.
But
so I think Ricardo was doing the same cash modeling, but in the CPU.
But this applies to pretty much any cash replacement. And that's what I want to generalize on any replacement at any level.
I think you need to do, like, I think Luis will point out that, like, you need to do, like, first you need to come up with mechanisms to maintain cache exclusivity, right?
Yeah.
In memory, it's easy, though.
In memory,
yeah,
it's very easy.
Cool. How is it non-virtualized system? How is it that?
In non-virtualized system, you have a single memory manager, right?
Okay.
And you can tell the virtual memory manager will have all the intelligence to figure out how to partition the cache across processes. So you would just do that. Now, for instance, for the file system pages, there could be some sharing across processes, and then that becomes a little tricky.
Yeah.
But for anonymous pages, the process memory is pretty straightforward. Right? The page is only typically owned by one process. Then you decide whether a page from process A gets to stay or page from process B gets to stay, and that would be based on how the partition works for anonymous pages. Yes, for page cache pages is more tricky.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that okay, if a process accessed a page in the file system, then that belongs to that process, right? You could do something like that. But then if another process goes and accesses
anonymous pages can also be shared.
They could be shared. So I'm not saying that.
A little trickier too.
Yeah. So there are some corner cases certainly that need to be addressed. But I mean, I think we are talking one step ahead than what we should be talking. I think characterizing what you mean by that wastage and how big is that.
But we thought we could go at the same time with understanding what's going on and using it for something. Right? Using it for something doesn't have to wait until you understand what's going on.
No. Okay, you use something.
Because it happens all the time.
Well, for that, I think I somehow feel that unless you understand what's going on, you really cannot solve the problem or even use it in the best possible way, right?
Well, people have been using it without understanding it.
I think it's harder to sell it that way because you might say, okay, it works in your environment, does it work everywhere, universally? And if you have some kind of a more solid foundation for what you're doing, I think that can be more convincing, that people will be willing to buy, okay, you did your experiments and it worked for you and it's likely to work for other people as well.
Okay.
Right? But if you're saying, oh, I don't understand it, but it seems like this solution works, right? And then there might be other questions. Oh, yeah, it works for you, but maybe it doesn't work for me because I have no idea what you're doing and why it is working for you. It's harder to sell it that way.
Okay. So on the understanding of this thing, I mean, what we saw experimentally is that as you increase the number of workloads, there is more wastage. Wastage happens for different replacements. We saw it for R, for LRU, for LFU. Pretty much we always see it happen, but we don't know for sure why it's that.
So it's not clear to me why the wastage would go away if you just divide it.
The thing is that the wastage is really big. You know what, you all know what an MRC is? An MRC is a curve of mean freight versus cash price. So it usually goes something like this, like step function. So let's say this is the step function for workload 1, and you have another one for workload 2. So you could say that the usage of cash of workload 2 is this. Because after this size, you don't use the cache anymore. You could say the same about workload 1, is this. Because after this point, you don't use the cache anymore.
You will not get any benefit.
You don't get any benefit from the cache. So if you now mix workload 1 and workload 2, you get a new mean freight curve, which would be something like, let's say, this.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that this new point is always, always larger or equal than this plus this.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
And that's what you define as a wastage. That difference.
This difference is what I define as a wastage. And we saw this for.
Yeah, but okay, all. I understand that. But
yeah.
Why? What's not clear to me is why would that wastage be smaller if you subdivide the cache?
Because now if you subdivide the cache, it would be like if this guy was running along. It's like this mean freight curve along.
That's what's not clear to me.
It would
and
be because...
Because, I mean, you're having a cache that is larger.
I guess the reason... why the wastage happened? Do you understand that?
I guess that's one of the questions we want to answer. Why is this?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that, I mean, the wastage happened is because there are some stages in one process that are accessed once and override the cache of the second process, right? So that means that now the second ones will have a miss because of that.
So
if you divide the cache, that won't happen.
So you have to remove the interference, cache interference.
Exactly.
The thing is that if you gave both these caches, this plus this, and you mix them and run them together, they will start interfering each other. But let's say if you give workload 1 exactly this amount of cache for all the workload run, and just this and nothing less than this, you will run with this curve. Because it's running along, it's running in the same configuration as it was when it was running along.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we had to clearly characterize the wastage as to what it is, right? How much it is.
Yeah.
Because if the wastage is 1%, then is it really worth the effort of, you know, coming up with some really smart algorithm that online does this careful partitioning? I mean, right, so we had to answer that question. And second is to come up with an example that can go beyond just the sequential. I think the reason you talked about the sequential case is to illustrate to everyone easily, but I think if you use that in a paper, people might have doubts about what you're talking
about. Actually, even people at VMware said, okay, but you can address that by using MSU or ARC.
Yeah, because that's a special case.
Yeah, it's true. But I think, I guess we have to come up with a stronger example, but I think it's...
Hmm.
Another interesting thing is that as you increase the number of workloads, this wastage increases.
Mm-hmm.
So it's scaling very nice. So in a virtualized environment, we have thousands of processes, VMs, mixing stuff.
Yeah.
You get.
Maybe that's where your case is. Maybe instead of just saying two workloads and there is some wastage, to me it seems like that could be really small. But then if you can show that it doesn't scale linearly as you start putting more virtual machines in and it grows like super linearly, then it can become a significant problem.
Yes. Okay.
Right. I think that's a good argument to have.
Another thing about this is that this also depends on how you schedule processes.
Of course.
So another thing would be to design schedulers to do things in a smart way. IO schedulers and CPU schedulers.
Combining with this.
Yeah. But because you don't understand what's going on, it's like a new
But you already have some.
Yeah, we have some. We have some modeling for LRU, but it doesn't work. By the way.
So you can write another paper to show that.
What we did doesn't work. Yeah.
But did you calculate the percentage saving you can potentially have?
Yeah, really depends on the workers.
Okay. Yeah. About the ranges, I think I saw.
I mean, you can have like extreme cases where a worker is missing all the time, and when you partition, is missing half.
Yeah, that is an infinite time improvement, right? Because you have essentially 0% hit rate, and anything better than zero is an infinite improvement.
Okay.
Yeah. So one question. So do you see any easy way of doing this without having those miss ratio curves?
No.
So you need to profile the application a lot and make your decisions based on historical data.
Yes, and this goes to the next idea, which is given an MRC, create a trace.
Mm-hmm.
Just that little problem. Given an MRC, create a trace. An MRC is like a nice representation of the locality of a worker. This program that converts an MRC into a trace will be really helpful for this model.
Create a memory access trace.
Yeah.
I think that's not a hard problem.
Actually, I thought it that way, but I've been trying to do it, and it's pretty complicated.
Okay, so I think we should stop this discussion because still we are on first idea. So
yeah.
We should move on to. We'll come to your number two and three after we go around the table.
Yeah. So no, we can continue with.
I mean, that was my idea. So
okay.
We are doing one.
So okay. Okay. So you get. Yeah. You get one more 4 minute.
Okay.
Speech.
Well, no, we can continue discussing that, right? What you were saying, or you have another idea?
Have. No, I have one more idea.
Mm.
For this MRC wasted stuff that
well, going back to the getting a trace from a MRC, right? So one thing that I found is that I was actually getting a similar, no, looking at it in a different way. So if you plot on the y-axis instead of miss ratio, no, what's that?
Miss rate.
So, okay. Miss rate.
Actually, it could be total number of miss.
So if I plot it, miss percentage, right?
Okay.
So if you look at it in terms of miss percentage and cache size, and I was able just to using reuse distance to get a very accurate curve.
Oh yeah, but that will be just for
LRU. Yeah.
It will be just for LRU. That's
but
true.
We want it for any.
No, well, it will be for LRU type algorithm. It will be a lower bound.
Okay.
Right?
So
it will be a lower.
I think you explain it to me later.
It will be a lower bound, right? So from that, it's essentially saying, okay, if you use you have a cache size, and then you let me put it.
So this is hit percentage. And this is cache size. So if you have a cache of 1 and then of 10, right? So if you have here 1 and then let's say 5%, that means that 5% of your guys are going to be accessed twice in a row, right?
Okay.
And then if you have 10 and then you have let's say a probability of some and you plot this as a like a you have some bars, right? Some probability. Let's say you have here 50%, right? So 50% of the time you're gonna access the same element every 10 and do that sort of thing. Probably if you look at it this way, it's probably easier to come up with a training set.
Okay.
Mm.
You start with the high frequency elements or the other?
No, I mean I'm not sure how to start, but if you look at it that way, like for every
you have an implementation
for
this?
We can talk about that later.
Okay.
In more details, but no, because I mean I did the other way around. No, I didn't. I did from a trace extract that, not
It's like the MRC.
Exactly.
There is an algorithm for it. It's called, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay, so I think we should move on to the next one. Jorge, what do you have in mind?
Okay, so I have two ideas. So one of the ideas is that so in this sort of layered storage that a lot of people are going to right now, one of the problems is that you have to track information for pieces of data that you access. Right, and sometimes if you access a lot of information, it's very hard to track for every piece of data.
You mean stats?
Exactly. Keep statistics for pieces of data, right? So let's say if you track at 4K granularity, for 1 terabyte you will have,
A lot.
Probably hundreds of megabytes of stats. Right, so, but the thing is that you don't access all data in the same frequency, right? You usually have an exponential distribution of accesses. Right, let's say you have 1% of the data having something like 50% of the accesses. And then it degrades sort of exponentially. So the idea is to leverage that exponential access pattern and also collect stats at a fixed granularity, but at some exponential granularity. So for the data that you access a lot, you have small fine-grained stats, and for the data that you access that you don't access very frequently, you have coarser-grained stats and possibly less information even. Right. So, and that's something that could also be used not only in storage but in other layers. For instance, for what Luis is saying. Right, that could be something that's used, right, for things that you access very frequently, and you can even have sort of a probability of what you're going to access next and all that sort of thing, so you can do prefetching and that sort of smarter stuff. And for things that you access only one, you just keep probably something that says, okay, this I access, or something like that, and you can have it even at a, let's say, terabyte granularity or something like that.
Mm.
And one possible way to implement this is to using the buddy system that some memory managers use, right?
Mm.
So something like that.
Mm.
And that's basically my idea.
So you say, okay, I have a 1 terabyte volume.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start with maybe just one stat for the entire terabyte volume,
mm-hmm.
and if there is a lot of axes
to that
1 terabyte
flow,
volume,
yeah.
Then I split it into two,
mm-hmm.
and then I have two stats, and if I see that for both of these guys there is a lot of activity, or maybe just one of them, then I split the guy,
yeah.
and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what this reminds me of. I mean, of course, buddy allocator is one, but even in terms of statistics collection, I'm trying to see if there are people who have utilize this.
But also the idea is to keep more statistics the higher you go.
Right.
Right, because the idea is that the higher you go is that the more frequently you access that data.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an increased probability of accessing it again.
Mm.
Right, and since that distribution, like I said, is exponential,
mm.
optimizing for that small piece of memory could possibly bring you higher benefits along the road,
mm.
and enable all different optimizations.
Go ahead.
You go ahead.
The goal here is not to reduce the amount of metadata, I'm assuming, right?
That's the goal.
That's one of the goals.
It's not clear to me, because as you start partitioning your area in which you have more frequency, then the partition is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, but like I said, you have an exponential access pattern usually.
So it is guaranteed that the amount of data that you're going to generate for that is less?
I would imagine so.
Yeah, I have the same question.
Not
what kind of statistics? I mean, as you said, there is some metadata, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is the statistics, and I don't get it that... I think
Okay,
If the granularity goes small, you need to keep more statistics because you're making your granularity smaller. But I don't quite get it that how you're you need to keep more metadata per.
Okay, so let's assume that I keep a fixed amount of metadata independent of the granularity.
Let's say just average.
Exactly. Let's say it says, I don't know, 10 bytes, right?
Per 4K,
right? If I did it at 100K, let me get the number. Okay, so if I keep 10 bytes, and if I do it at let's say 100K, let's say 100 megabytes to keep things easier. Then for every terabyte, mm-hmm. I essentially have 100 bytes.
100,000, I guess.
100,000
bytes.
I think
maybe we can make it more simpler again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way I see it is that if before you have, let's say, a fixed amount of data at for coarse grain things, mm-hmm. and you have a lot of those, and now you have things that are variable size.
Mm-hmm.
You have and with the idea that there's an exponential distribution on the number of axes, you're gonna have a lot more pieces. You're gonna have pieces that are smaller, but those are eventually gonna, the sum of all the pieces that you're gonna have is I'm almost positive that it's gonna be smaller. That is, you have divided the whole thing into fixed size pieces.
Yeah, intuitively speaking, that makes sense if your distribution is very, what's the word for that, it's skewed, it's very compressed in that one area,
mm-hmm.
then that makes sense. But if that's the case, that gets a little bit bigger, I mean, we're talking about servers, right? So we're talking about how much data here.
But, I mean, if all the...
I can put a cap and say that my smaller piece would be 4K,
yeah.
so it would, you never...
Yeah. And even 4K is a very small size. You can. Depends. You can make it.
I have another question. So to do this, you have to measure frequency, right?
Yeah,
that's one statistic.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you measure frequency at a lower granularity if you have a higher granularity statistic?
Oh yeah.
How do you measure frequency at a lower granularity when you're actually using a higher granularity?
Oh, so your question is okay, so basically when you split,
mm-hmm.
how do you divide the statistics?
No, okay, so let's say that, well, the first question is when you decide to split, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, once you split, how do you know which one is more accessed?
Well,
because you need to maintain statistics.
No, but you already split it, right? So there are two independent pieces.
But how did you know?
Right, but at the moment that when you make the partition, you have to partition that, right? Divide into the two pieces. So you have to have
you
got
separate information. You start information.
Yeah, you could do many things there. You could divide it by half of what you have, or you can say, okay, both get as if they were equal. The maximum statistic, I mean, there are some ways of doing that.
I'm not understanding. Can we see graphically? Let's say you have this amount of samples.
Okay.
And let's say it turns out that any moment these samples are more useful based on frequency or whatever, you determine that you need to get another average just on this and another average on all of these.
I think when you say that you focus on that,
then speak it.
What is that?
Right?
This
that's the axis distribution.
Right.
Yeah.
So this here has a higher frequency.
Oh, okay, that's what I'm saying. Let's say this
will be here.
Is this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you determine then that you need to get an average and one value for average for these guys.
Mm-hmm. Let's say that, okay.
Okay. So then let's say everything starts to be uniform again, so you get an average of all of this again. And you get one sample now.
So
for
in
all
that example here, you really have only two partitions, I guess.
Exactly,
here,
yes.
And then here.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what you're saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that could be.
So, I mean, I have the same question as Rich. I mean, before you were getting stats for the whole thing,
you get an average frequency and everything for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you determine this if you don't have stats per
Like I said, you can just say, okay, now I'm just going to say, and I'm assume that that those pieces were accessed in the same fashion. So I can divide the stats by half and say, okay, you get half of the, let's say I'm assuming that you this portion got half of the access and this other portion had half of the access. Or I can say, okay, they both, let's say they both had the access of the maximum.
And then you refine it afterwards.
Exactly. There are many ways of looking that. I'm not sure which is the better approach to take when you split or when you combine again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
I think this reminds me of the, I think in the geospatial image data manipulation, there is this quad tree concept.
Yeah.
Where you have, you know,
you take a giant block and you say, well, if this is the same, you just consider it. You break that block into smaller ones.
Yeah. So, for instance, if you have a map of the world, right? Oceans, you don't need much data, right? When you go to cities, you probably need more fine-grained resolution of various stats.
Mm-hmm.
So, what they use is basically a quad tree, which is every time you want finer resolution, you break that into four parts. Right, because it's a two-dimensional space.
Okay.
Right, and then you could break it into two, but the
because
it's a square, you break it into four parts. So that's the main reason. But that's a sort of a similar idea, but you do this dynamically. But what you are saying is the dynamic part. What they do is a static division,
mm-hmm.
right? So they have resolutions which are sort of somewhat predetermined based on the density of population and things like that. But this is sort of a similar idea. Right?
So you believe that every 1 second that's dynamic.
Yeah.
But people don't move every...
Yeah.
So
basically your idea is to how to choose portion and dynamically chop it, and the other portion how to dynamically shrink it.
Yeah, I guess
burden of I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know how to do that, but
But that's the problem.
That's the idea.
That's
kind of like when you have partition here and you say, okay, now I'm going to divide this in two, the code is going to get
unbalanced.
Yeah. But I guess that's fine.
Yeah, my
intuition is that eventually you will balance it out. Mm-hmm. And then my guess is that you will end up having small pieces for the ones towards
right.
the left, and big pieces for the ones toward the right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess the challenge is not in terms of coming up with the initial partitioning,
mm-hmm.
but if the axis changes, how do you reconfigure your partitions? I think that's where the challenge is.
Merge
and dynamically split again, and because what was not popular moves up all the way up top, and then how do you sort of make sure that gets attention and so on. But it's an interesting problem.
And also the metrics need to have some properties, right? They need to be, for example, you can aggregate things. Like
Yeah, for instance, number of axes.
Yes.
Something like
that.
Yeah.
Those are the assumptions you need to make.
Yes.
So this would be useful in something like database applications where most databases
tend
to follow
sort of
the 8-point rule, so like 20
more
information.
I think not only database, but almost every application
finals.
Follows that rule.
Yeah.
At least what I have seen is
we have to move forward.
Yeah, we do have to move forward, yeah. Okay, Daniel.
Well,
what do you have in mind?
After the last paper club, I saw using this new non-volatile memory storage, but instead of using a sparse memory, using it as disks and try to build some file system that leverages all the options that they gave.
Mm.
Like if they access directly via the CPU, you don't need a cache to access the blocks.
Mm.
Even there is no blocks, so we can have inodes that specify range of the physical address space without telling these blocks having a different order, like branch trees or wherever, to specify how it's a file. And then,
in other words, build a file system for PCM.
For PCM.
Well, not necessarily TCM.
Well, wherever new non-volatile memory that is byte addressable and CPU are.
But the whole idea behind that is to eliminate the file system, right?
I mean, no, if you have that, you can use any application that is already written for using file system, but using this new, very fast storage.
True, but then someone will argue that it's easier and less expensive to have a small subsystem to export that interface, but it doesn't handle the memory of the file system. The file systems are big and complex. And if you have this volatile, this memory that is not volatile, there's no need to have files, right? You data sort of turn and start
the system. You're building your file system. You just need to specify how to name files, and then all the management of files is your implementation. You can make it as hard or easy as you want, right?
The other thing I see is that, in that case, if that kind of memory exists, then it doesn't make much sense to access things as file. I mean, basically the read or write system call should be removed and everything should be handled as mmap, right?
But you still have files.
You still have files, but I mean, read and write goes away. But it's true, I mean, you still need inodes and how. Or you need to metadata to know where things
because
are.
Because people still organize stuff in Python directly.
Yeah.
The idea is that the file system will map this write and read operations to unmap and just write without caching and everything.
Oh,
I see. To make it transparent to the RAM. Because there are many applications that are already reading.
Only when it's here.
That makes sense.
If you didn't have files, you wouldn't have any files.
No, that's
big idea.
Well, we'll come back to that. I think Ricardo's point is, well, you do need files. You cannot live without files, right?
No, that's people used important. To files.
Huh?
That's also
you're also making the same point that we need files.
I agree with him. I mean, we still need files, but for PCM, we need to implement file systems in a different way.
Yeah.
Because it's not only block addressable. You can address by bytes, and you can do a lot of fancy, cool stuff.
Right. The files are interesting because they've been around with us for forever, right?
Yeah.
So we cannot think without them. But one of the projects that we are doing, which is software persistent memory, shows that, you know, if you know what your data looks like, you can manage all your data and data structures, which in the end you would anyway. Mm-hmm. Right? You can not have to deal with files at all. Right? So if you know what your data structure is, and if your data magically shows up inside your data structures, would you still want to manage files?
Well, you still need some way of way of...
He's talking about the naming. Like,
right,
you start your application.
How do you identify your data, basically?
That's
yeah.
a tag.
Yeah, but that, yeah, it could be a tag. Right.
When if you have a sea of data structures, where your piece of data ends when the other piece of data...
So you just have a tag, right? I mean, that's the problem of whichever system is managing the data. But if you're an application,
right.
If you know the tag of your data structure and you know what the signature of your data structure is, would you still want to manage files? Like, would you still want to figure out how to convert your data structures and fit them into files?
But, right. I mean, that already happens in some sense. I mean, applications right now, what it does is to allocate some memory and you read a file into that data structure. You have the data structure populated.
I know, but if you didn't have to do that.
But it's just a convenience thing. But it's,
I mean,
exactly
it's extra work. I mean,
yeah.
The way I see it, you think it's convenience that you have to read from a file and put it into a data structure?
No.
But I'm saying if your data structure just magically shows up for you, you just start reading and writing into your data structure.
Right. I
understand that, but I don't see... How is that different from
reading
from into a better structure?
Outside the box.
it's like a generalization of a file system structure, right?
Besides, the file system includes many things. I mean, there is your own file system, how you lay things down.
Yeah, so let's say that all that is taken care of for you, right? I mean, for instance, the writing to the data structure can be atomic, right?
Journaling is transparent to the developer. He doesn't know that journaling is going on. So you could have journaling also for the other system.
Yeah, that's fine, right? I mean, that also happens right now. I guess, yeah.
I mean, the reason we are talking about accessing memory is because these new technologies are memory-like. right? So if you still want to use a file, you could, but the question is, can you live without files for your application? And if you can, maybe you should think about not using files. The other thing, though, I mean, where files are useful is when you have two applications that don't know anything about each other, right? And then you have all these standardized formats which help to transmit data, right? So if it's an ASCII file, I know, okay, what and how to read an ASCII file regardless of which application, right?
It's not an ASCII,
but that's a lot, those are data structures.
That's the same thing. You could specify that the structure inside your file, and then
I guess so, yeah. So if they have a way to figure out how to read that data structure information itself, then they don't need to figure out formats, right? Just read the data structure, instantiate that, and load your data into that data structure and manipulate.
I guess you're talking about is more like avoiding the step of doing the marketing,
the
right? No, no. I mean,
also
IO. It's like you have your name, right? Mm-hmm. You say I want to access these data structures, and somehow you have the data structure, right?
But it's like a read operation.
It's a different kind of. I guess granularity. Instead of saying each data structure, what I do is I partition all my data into a few distinct hierarchies of structures.
Okay.
Right. And if I want to work on my student database, I just load the entire student database into a data structure. Now that doesn't mean that everything gets loaded into memory. It's like you demand page your data structures as they get utilized. Right. But you directly work with your student database structure without having to read individual records.
And how is that different from nmapping, for instance?
Nmapping just gives you a byte range, right? A set of bytes. And then you need to figure out what's inside those bytes. And then there are some limitations with directly putting your data structures inside an nmap file, because then you cannot remap your file into some other location, pointers gets messed up. And well, anyway, I think we are talking about something that we shouldn't talk about.
But how is it different from reading from a file than from reading from a data structure?
You don't need to read it. That's the whole point. So you don't need to read at all. You just say, okay, create my magic data structure, and you don't do anything else.
No, but somehow you need to retrieve the data.
Somebody has to read.
Yeah, the library does it for you, or the OS does it for
you. The point is that, yeah, let's say that somebody does it for you.
Hmm. Right, so that's what these guys are building, right? I mean, the Software Persistent Memory project is about that, is to, maybe you guys should use it and tell us what, whether it's useful or not.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw about this system is that if you need to write, you don't need to read to the base cache to do the write and then read.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot another thing. But... You don't really need to have fixed blocks. Then your files are arranged that are by all size. Then it can be messy to keep track of all the range, but that's part of the system.
Yeah, but at the end, you also need smaller blocks, because then your metadata will be huge. So, I mean,
yeah, if not bigger blocks, you mean? You mean that you cannot partition.
Exactly. You cannot have bytes, bytes all over the place, because then you would have a lot of metadata.
It's also depending on your application. If you have a huge sequential array and then just 3 or 4 bytes, it can be possible.
Okay. I mean, you could manage it like you manage main memory.
Right.
But if you have variable size blocks, then there is this other thing that you could in some points try to make blocks and stage it out to another device, like flash.
But you'd be using a slab allocator.
It's like tiering. The idea is that this device is bi-addressable and should be smaller than flash and faster than flash, but you want to have a lot of data. But you want to use all your data using this bi-addressable file system or wherever.
Right.
So some data will be called, and then you need to assemble some kind of block to stage it out to a block level file system, because this one is bi-addressable, so there is a problem there.
Right, so there are there is mismatch in the access granularity, and you can do a lot with a file system that's just tuned for these non-volatile memories, right? I think that's interesting. Though I'm kind of skeptical about this whole non-volatile memory space, right?
Before
it
comes out.
Yeah, before it comes out, I don't think it's worth your time doing this. Right, because you don't know what the properties of the device are going to be in the end, and even if it's going to see the light of day, right, it may never show up. And then you spend like 2 years building a file system which is basically unusable, right? So I don't know. I'm a little.
Well, at least I'm thinking that if the end doesn't seem light, or the other one doesn't seem light, some of them should, in some moment, change the interface to byte.
It's possible, but what if it doesn't happen in, let's say, 10 years' time? Is this the right time to build a file system like that? Right. Even I was speaking to this lady from Fusion.io, right, at this workshop I was at in DC, and she was saying that they are not looking at any of these PCM devices either because of the pretty much the same reasons, that they don't know what the timeline looks like, and they don't know what the devices will look like when they do come out. And so they don't want to invest any time, you know, especially, I mean, Fusion.io is like on the cutting edge of all the non-volatile or faster device technology. So if anyone, they should be looking at this stuff, and they are not. It's just the academic folks who are looking at this stuff at this point.
Well,
and I've seen that in the past happening, and nothing comes out of that sometimes. So you have to be careful.
The bright side is that you don't have too much competence.
There is already one paper about that.
About
from Microsoft Research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Better IO through byte-addressable.
Right.
Or whatever.
What about
right.
something simpler? Because let's say that this does work, right?
Mm.
Let's say that the company is actually capable of building this type of memory.
Oh, they're already building it.
Right, but that's the point that it makes sense to use it, that is. Because at the beginning, I'm assuming that you're going to have, when people start using it on production servers, there's going to be a mix. You're going to mix it. You're going to have maybe some volatile memory, non-volatile, and you're going to continue using hard disk because those are not going to disappear just right away, right now, right? So perhaps it will make sense to build a system that could use this type of memory and port and interface a file that is not really a file system. It's something more lightweight and
so something easier. That is not clear to me is, so if this memory comes integrated into systems, would it be better to use it as for files or something like what the hybrid memory project that you guys are doing?
Mm.
Right, probably it makes more sense for a hybrid memory approach.
More than files, and you...
Yeah, because it will be a very limited amount of memory, at least at the beginning.
Right.
Oh, but and then it's better just to manage it as an extension to your RAM, I would assume.
As I see it, you have options, right? You can use...
Yeah, I mean, of course, you have... I mean,
somebody needs to provide you...
Right, but the good thing about this system that allows you to write files into that is... Because you can use any other existing applications to store that information there. There could be access faster.
You could speed up existing applications.
Right.
It's true.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's one of the arguments that the Microsoft research paper was making, is that you need to build a file system for all these legacy applications, and also because people like to think in files, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't do that, then you're not able to use these new technologies. Okay, so I guess we should move on. Jesus, do you have?
Okay,
Sajid?
Yeah, I have an idea about the stuff I'm doing. It's a little different, but from a different perspective because of the SLO violation thing.
Mm.
So I want to like put up some things.
Mm-hmm.
Can I repeat it, please?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's not mine. We're talking about that. That is mine.
That was actually mine.
Oh, it's not mine. So, people are doing a lot of research on those SLO violations, like how to maintain SLO, how to move stuff in the dynamic environment, how to do resource allocation properly. But I think there are still some things which people are not addressing. So let's say, is that the
particular market?
Yeah. and throw that one.
And throw one, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's say this is a data center. We have several steps to manage this data center. One is this row profiler, which is monitoring the data. Other is a load balancer. And another way is the resource allocator. What's happening is that most of the times these things are not coordinating much between themselves. So either load balancer is acting based on some high level metric it gets from profiler, it balances stuff across different physical machines, or resource allocation is just looking at a different perspective, like how to in a pool of machines how to provide resources to guarantee some sort of resource sort of SLA agreement or some data center level metric. But what I'm trying to say is that can we say that now that an application which is running in a virtualized environment in a data center, can we guarantee somehow that their SLA won't be violated within some, let's say, 95th percentile of the time the SLO won't be violated? Can we somehow guarantee that? So most of the time what is happening is that once SLO violation happens, we do a lot of fancy stuff. We either use resource allocation, we either use load balancer. Once the violation happens, once the flag is raised, we do a lot of things based on the resource metric. But can we somehow forecast before that the SLO violation is going to happen and use these tools to make better arrangements so that we avoid the SLO violation in near future, which is bound to happen? So
you're saying in some sense, chart the trend in performance and see, okay, well, performance is going down. But in 20 minutes, I'm going to...
It's not from the performance perspective. So what I'm coming from that, let's say we are only pulling out... Yeah, we need some sort of performance metric.
Yeah.
Like what is the performance of the each virtual machine application. But somehow can I corroborate this performance metric with the profiler metric?
So Sajid, one question there is, okay, so you have to be then cautious not to... your forecast model not to be very aggressive, because then you'll spend more time by pre-allocating resources than by paying for your SLA violation, right?
Yeah, that's why the forecasting model should be very good.
Yeah, so that's the problem.
Yeah, that's why the research problem comes up. Since in the data center we use a lot of stats are already being collected. A lot of stats about the resource usage, the CPU ready queue, the memory statistics, the ballooning statistics, the SWAT statistics, and same goes for IO statistics. There are a whole bunch of statistics available. So what are the most of the existing work does is that the papers we are discussing, that the fingerprinting the data center, that those papers are like, okay, those SLO violations have appeared before, and those are the things that affected, that are the cause of those SLO violations. And they try to categorize the problems, but looking at from the past. But can you just some sort of say that use the recent history to build a better forecasting so that those sort of using those profiler metrics, use a better forecasting so that those violations can be prevented in recent times. And that's not very easy, because thing is that they're looking at just for a simple metric, like let's say the CPU ready metric. Just from a simple, there could be a lot of metrics available. Let's just focus on an example like CPU ready metric. If the CPU ready time of a VM is high, that means it's waiting in the queue. The requests are waiting in the queue. But then you can say, okay, why don't you just raise the limit? But those are not straightforward, because CPU ready.
You mean limit in terms of the CPU allocation?
CPU limit. Allocation.
So instead of giving it 1 GHz, give it 2 GHz.
Yeah.
So it's CPU ready goes down.
CPU ready goes down. But those are not easy, because thing is that CPU ready could be high for different reasons. CPU ready could be high because your allocation, total the physical machine is going high, or because you put an artificial limit on that.
So there are several constants.
Or there is an I/O. Well, you cannot be CPU ready if you're waiting on I/O, right?
Yeah. So there could be different scenarios that could arise, and each of the metrics, this, for example, if the limit is artificially enforced, for example, then the resource allocation with the next interval will just raise the limit, CPU limit, so that your CPU return goes down. But and load balancer will do different things. Load balancer will look at the physical machine perspective and see if the total utilization of the CPU is too high. Maybe that's the problem because CPU ready is too high. So they will just move this VM to another physical machine. So there are different scenarios, different modules abstract, different modules, what you say, like, solve the problems in a different way. But why can't we just use the statistics, like recent statistics, and try to see that which is the best way to do in the near future to avoid the SLA violation?
So even I think the question about SLO, avoiding the SLO violation, right? I'm trying to see if there has been work in that space. I cannot think of anything right away in terms of existing work. So yeah, I think that's an interesting problem because
there are work, but they're all related work. We're not trying to build a holistic system based on this. And there are works like how the load balancer works to avoid, because SLO can be maintained in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
SLO can be maintained by doing resource allocation. SLO can be maintained by load balancer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm solving the problem from a different angle.
Right, so a more holistic approach.
More holistic approach.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because these modules, as you call it, they operate at different granularity, right?
Exactly.
Resource allocation
so
operates at the granularity of a resource unit. So for instance, you give 1 gigabyte of additional memory to a machine. So that's what the resource allocator would do. This load balancer, I think the VMware term for it is, what do they call this? No.
DRS.
Right, dynamic resource, whatever. So, yeah, scheduler. So that operates at the granularity of entire virtual machines. The move the virtual machines from one physical host to another physical host.
Based on the metrics again.
Right. So these are a different granularity. So it's not immediately obvious to me whether they are conflicting solutions. I mean, so you have to kind of, I think, show some examples, concrete examples, where decisions made by the resource allocator would conflict with the decision simultaneously made by the load balancer. Because they operate on different granularities, I also suspect they operate on different triggers,
mm-hmm.
right? So you had to show, okay, that the triggers coincided and the load balancer did something which was very different than what the resource allocator does to solve exactly the same problem, right? So I think that would be a good motivation for what you're suggesting, if you can come up with concrete examples of that kind.
Okay.
But I can see, I mean, things can go horribly wrong if they are not coordinated well, or they are working to solve the same problem in very conflicting ways, right? So
they have conflicts. For example, load balancer is very simple. Load balancer will see, okay, this is, I will raise a flag whenever the actual CPU utilization of the physical machine goes beyond 85%.
Hmm.
And then I will try to pick up a virtual machine which is less contentious or more contentious to some machine which is less, with some dynamic optimization.
Right. So the first thing is to show that those triggers can coincide, right? Trigger for resource allocation, or even if they are not coinciding, that one decision that was made right now by the resource allocator was sort of negated or undone by the load balancer pretty soon, right? Because of a different trigger going off. And if you can show that these triggers are somewhat correlated, to say if one happens, then the next one will likely happen, and the decisions made by these two entities would end up negating each other, right? So I think it's interesting. I think there is a problem there, but it needs to be motivated with the
There is another aspect also, like things that, but those all the two problems are saying that it cannot guarantee that the SLO will be
won't be violated. I mean, it can only manage after the violation happens.
Mm.
It can manage better, like, those are like managers when the problem happens, the crisis manager. But can we just say that with the crisis can be prevented beforehand?
Mm.
That's the thing, I also another aspect of the work.
Mm.
Like trying to see this data, like profile data, and see that, okay, one crisis might happen now. So try to avoid this, and what are the best things we can do to avoid that crisis? These are the questions.
Mm.
Maybe one case, resource allocation, that's what I'm saying, the limit, increasing the limit, and if there is a space, increasing the limit is a solution. But maybe in another case, just moving the stuff is a better solution.
Mm.
So can we just forecast it beforehand and try to prevent the SLO from being violated?
I had a very specific issue related to what you're talking about. What we've been doing is that we predict latency based on cache size. We have a curve like this for all VMs.
Okay.
And we use these curves to assign caches to all VMs to, for example, all
so you have one curve per VM.
One curve per VM. The thing is that the way we're doing things right now is we get what this curve based on the previous accesses of the, let's say, last hour. The thing is that, let's say you had something like this. Let's say in the morning you had this, then later you had this, and now you have this. There's clearly some pattern here. It means that the next couple of hours you will most likely be somewhere like here. So this approach of just using the last period of time is not really helping a lot.
I'm not saying the last period.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. So we should do something like what you're proposing, like predict these curves. And pretty much all you're saying is that it's predicting curves like this, let's say for CPU ready or for whatever metric that you control, giving some resource. So all of this reduces to this, getting these curves and predict these curves.
Kind of. And doing the better judgment also in later cases. I mean, predicting this curve is one part.
Yeah, and the other part is taking action.
Oh, well, about using these curves and do something, for example, giving more or less resources to load balance, where there's a lot of work there.
There is a lot of work, but what is the better option to do?
Well, there is conflict between this and this, whether you use this or whether you use this, or you give weight to this or weight to this, but there is conflict. That's clear.
There is a conflict.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Well, there can be conflict.
There can be, but it's not necessary.
Yeah. But if there is a conflict, you need some arbitrary way of deciding who's winning, right? That's an input. So that's not the issue.
Now, the thing is that there is no real reason for why these two entities need to be distinct.
Sure.
You could have a single controller that does both actions,
yeah.
Right? So just because maybe current systems, those are two independent entities,
we
are saying that there is a problem, but I mean a solution that integrates those two may not, the conflict may no longer be an issue. Because there is a single decision coming out of that decision maker, right? It's not two separate decisions that are in conflict with each other. So I think the fact that you're assuming an architecture that looks like this with two pretty much independent entities, I don't think you should rely on that too much, right?
Okay.
But you still have that problem. You still have the forecasting problem. You still have the decision-making problem.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's something worthy look at, I agree.
But what Ricardo is addressing is that not only I'm looking at my solution, because historical data is also important.
Yeah.
Let's say on each Monday you have a several spike at 12 a.m. At some time of the day. So
how do you use all that stuff to predict the next hour?
Combination of recent history and the patterns and patterns to make better forecasts.
Remember we had a visit by Alma Riska?
Mm-hmm.
He actually was not there.
You were not here? Yeah, her work addresses that to some extent with how do you combine short-term with long-term stable patterns of that kind.
With reinforcement learning or something?
No,
I don't know.
No,
she was using something else.
but I can
it was more it. Actually very intuitive and very
yeah.
simple.
It could be the six patterns.
Yeah. Well, it was using some kind of a history and the pattern in the history, right?
It was a probabilistic, some kind of probability distribution of something.
Whether it explicitly detects
yeah,
the pattern or not is
right.
not clear.
Yeah.
But yeah, look at.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was pattern. It was just ions. Her case was only ions.
Yeah, predicting something.
Predicting ions. Yeah.
Yeah, predicting something based on not just short term but also long term, or
combining both.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm not even sure if it combined these two or just looked at the longer term.
I remember just a single graph. There was some probabilistic distribution. Oh, okay. She was doing how long will last these
idle time. Prediction of idle time.
Prediction of idle time. So she made a probability distribution of what was the probability of having this longer idleness given that you have been
idle for a certain amount of time already.
Yeah.
Right. So if you are already idle for X amount of time, which you've observed, what is the probability that you will be idle for a certain so if you know all the total distribution of idle times, then actually this is a fairly, turns out to be very intuitive solution to that question.
Well, you can do the opposite. Measure the peaks.
How long will the peaks
last?
I think these prediction problems, like, people don't usually give crap about it, but I think it's the key to visualization and consolidation. It's the key question, prediction. I mean, it is, right? I mean, if you knew what's going on,
the thing is that prediction is not an exact science.
No, of course, but there is very few stuff that we've been doing. We just have moving averages and that's it.
Or
yeah.
we say, that's another problem.
That's when you see that.
Or we say, that's another problem, yeah.
That's when you can see that the plans of balancing or something gets it very low, like 80%, 70%, to avoid those situations. So they are conservative. So they know that predictions might be completely wrong, so be conservative in our approaches.
Like, what's the name of systems that just adapt to problems? There is a name for this.
Autonomic?
There is a relation and you adapt. A relation and you adapt. You don't predict anything. There is a name for that.
Reactive.
Reactive, I think. No, I don't know. But there is a name for that.
Well, in robotics, there is reactive.
They have this autonomic computing.
Machine learning?
I don't know. Yeah.
You don't care anymore.
Yeah. It's the key. Prediction is the key.
But there is a potential, a lot of machine learning techniques that could be used in this case.
Yeah.
Especially for over this choosing of short-term prediction versus long-term prediction. I was reading that the reinforcement learning is a good way to determine. It's figured out based on some metrics what is the best choice to do at this current moment, whether to go for long-term optimization or for short-term prediction.
Mm-hmm.
If you're so interested about the future, you should go and talk to Walter Mercado.
Oh, yeah.
That's an astrologer.
Like a human
astrologer.
Yeah. Miami.
Really?
Yeah.
He's
cute. I was sure he was cute.
I don't know about that.
Or Puerto Rican?
I don't know.
Spoiler.
Really? Seems like all of you guys have already been there.
No, he's in television all the time.
Yeah.
You look at him, you don't know if he's a woman or a guy.
Very weird guy.
He's pathetic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we should talk more about it. I'm really interested about
it. So we should move on, I think.
Yeah.
We have two or three more things to talk about.
Right.
Leonardo, what do you have in mind?
I'm not having any ideas at the moment.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe next time.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah. Well, I think we have other people waiting in line. So,
yeah.
We can go. Well, before you say, let me say my take, please.
Oh.
Yeah. Because I think it's important. I think Ricardo has been talking about this for a while, which is, I think, storage latency, right?
Yes.
And so Ajay and I, we had a chat at the USENIX technical conference this year, and he also is crazy about storage latency, right? And today morning I was telling Sajib that if you could guarantee storage latency, then you can do better performance prediction, because there are a lot of people who are building models for predicting the performance of virtual machines by saying, if I allocate if I give a 1 gigahertz CPU and a 1 gigabyte memory to this application, what does its performance look like? But the problem is that most applications use I/O, right? They access storage, which is shared, right? And there is no control over that today, right? There is no guarantee in terms of storage performance, right? So if you could change that, if you could guarantee storage performance, then the prediction problem becomes tractable in some sense, right? For instance, the work that Sajib is doing, which is performance prediction of virtual machines, it just predicts the performance by observing the latency, right? So you're saying, okay, if I can observe the latency, I can predict performance. But then the latency is not really in your control, right? You say, my current latency is 100 milliseconds, and therefore my performance is going to be so and so. But think about what you really want. You want some kind of guarantees in terms of performance, and to deliver on those guarantees, you need to be able to control everything that can affect performance, not just the amount of CPU share or the memory share, also the storage, right? So how do you build a storage system that can guarantee storage performance? So the first thing to answer there is, what do I mean by storage performance, right? What is that metric that accurately characterizes storage performance? So in the study that Sajib is doing, we saw that latency is actually pretty good characterization of storage performance. You know what latency you're getting, you know what storage performance you're getting. It's not about how much IOPS, because IOPS can be different and the latency can get affected very differently. But if you know what your latency looks like, as long as the application behavior is stable, you get the same, you can get very good performance prediction, right? So if we assume that is correct, that storage latency is the only metric that you really need to worry about if you want to guarantee storage performance, then the next question is, how do you build a storage system that provides you a guarantee on storage latency, right? And that's an unsolved problem right now, right? So if you think about typical virtualized environments, you have like a whole bunch of virtual machines, a whole bunch of virtual disks that is sitting somewhere across on a network in some file server or SAN device. And then what you really need to build is a storage box that guarantees per virtual disk latency. So there should be some sort of control interface to the storage box, and you should be able to say, okay, for this virtual disk, I want at most 50 millisecond latency, right? Now, the challenge there is that there is no control on what the virtual machine will do. If it starts bombarding the device with a lot of IOs, right, then it is pretty easy to overwhelm the storage device itself. So if it's doing 10,000 IOPS, then it's probably not feasible to guarantee 50 milliseconds. So although latency is the first order of specification in terms of performance guarantee, the guarantee is sort of a multi-dimensional problem. So you say something like, for this virtual machine, the virtual machine is going to experience 50 millisecond or better latency as long as the virtual machine does not exceed 1,000 IOPS, right? If the virtual machine exceeds 1,000 IOPS, then
we cannot guarantee.
I cannot guarantee you anymore.
But that's not that useful. It wouldn't be more useful to say something like 80% of the IOPS would be less than.
No, but the problem is that if let's say the virtual machine is doing 1,000 IOPS and
this box should do something like access control. If the thing starts admission control, you say, okay, you won't get it. Do you want to continue?
But the problem is that the virtual machine doesn't know where it blocked, right? It could block inside the hypervisor, it could block inside the storage device. All it sees is like a 1,000 second latency. Right, it doesn't know that the storage is actually throttling the IOPS, it sees one I/O or 10 I/Os that stuck for 1,000 seconds inside the pipeline. And that's an SLO violation. From the standpoint of the virtual machine, it's not from the standpoint of the storage device, right? So I think the point being that if you specify not just a latency bound but also a max IOPS bound, then the application that's running inside the virtual machine will be also aware that, okay, this is what is expected from me. As long as I don't send more than 1,000 IOPS, I can expect a 50 millisecond latency.
Oh, I understand. That's the limit of the device. I mean, the device cannot do better than that.
Yes.
Even if you give it all SSD in the device to this CN,
yes,
it cannot do
it. It cannot do better than that, right? So you do need admission control. You do need to say, okay, in the control interface, I can say VM10 now, instead of, you know, doing 1,000 IOPS, it's actually going to do a 10,000 IOPS. I'm going to make that change. I'm going to specify now because my load has increased, but I still want to retain my 50 millisecond latency guarantee. Now, at that point, the storage system that you build should be able to tell the interface, is that possible or not, right? That's the admission control, right? Can you do it? And if you cannot do it, you say, I cannot do it, then move the virtual disk to some other storage, which can do it, right? So that's kind of, if you are able to solve this problem, right, then your performance prediction becomes a lot more tractable.
Mm-hmm.
Say, okay, I can not just guarantee you 1 gigahertz CPU, 1 gigabyte memory or whatever, I can also guarantee you 50 millisecond latency or lower, and therefore I can guarantee you an application performance of at least a certain amount.
So this means that Ajay and you concluded that this cannot be controlled from the hypervisor, it needs to be controlled from the storage side?
You have to, because that's where everything mixes, right? I mean, you have...
So what VMware has been trying to do?
What?
VMware have been trying to do in vain to control...
No, they are doing it, but they are not guaranteeing any latency. It's just priorities, right? So you can say, okay, I'm going to issue different rate from the, what is that word?
Proportional, right?
The distributed proportional. So when you look at how many outstanding requests you have, and you control the length of the pipeline, right? And therefore you control congestion, but there is no guarantee from the storage side as to the latency because everything blends in there, right? So what you really want is a latency guarantee so that you can do better performance prediction, so that you can do all of this stuff in a more robust way, right? So that's one of the ideas that we have been talking about, and also thinking of doing something more than just a paper. I think we need to start with a paper that can solve this problem. It's hard, right? How do you build a storage system that can guarantee something like that? It's not easy. You need, in an efficient way, right? You want to build a storage system that utilizes not just disk drives, but also SSDs for efficiency. And because the workload is dynamic, I have a virtual disk that is 50 gigabytes, right? I need to guarantee a 50 millisecond latency. At some point, I use a portion of the 50 gigabytes. At some other point, I use a very different portion of the 50 gigabytes, right? Should I leave it all on disk, or should I move some parts of it to SSD dynamically to be able to guarantee the latency at the least cost, right? So those are the kinds of very challenging questions that you need to address.
You need to address profiler to understand whether workload, because you are seeing it from a storage perspective, right? So I'm assuming what I'm trying to say that you need to understand from a, let's say, a virtual machine is issuing a lot of random requests. So you need to sort of try to understand that what are the type of access and different things. Right?
Absolutely. So there is some work that Jorge has already done in terms of figuring out where to put what data dynamically, right, with the tiering work.
Okay.
But there is more. I mean, there all we are doing is, okay, let's try to maximize performance. Right? There is no concept of guarantee. Now, if your goal is guarantees on latency per VMDK, then your decision making could be very different, right? Mm-hmm. With the same input, the same pieces of information.
That's why I was also talking that not performance or revenue maximization, but a guarantee that the SLO won't be bothered.
Right. So if you want to do something like that, you have to guarantee disk latency, right, mm-hmm. Storage latency. Otherwise, it's hard to provide these sorts of guarantees.
There is one little fact that changes a bit of things for me. Is that turns out that the latency of 1 mile of fiber is the same latency as the one you get from a fusion IO read. So that means that this idea of having remote servers with remote data and things like that in the cloud and stuff like that won't have any guarantees for latency. You still need caching at the host side.
So it depends on what kind of latency you're talking about. If you're talking about 50 milliseconds, that's a lot, right?
No,
but if you're talking about 50 microseconds, that's a very different kind of latency guarantee. I think that we do not yet have applications that can, or so many applications that can utilize or require that sort of guarantee.
That's because there is none.
People are not building those applications.
But if there was such a guarantee from the storage side, people start using it immediately.
I think that even if you can build a storage which guarantees 50 millisecond latency, there is still value there. And even that is a hard problem, I think.
Okay.
I mean, especially if you're talking about building or putting a Fusion IO device into each server, yes, you're changing the problem a little bit because now you have this additional capability to cache things locally, right? But you will always have an issue with how much data you can put in inside the server itself. You will still have something across the network, data across the network, and question is how many misses you have on the Fusion IO device, and what sort of guarantees you need for those accesses. So you still have that problem.
So what I'm saying is that I thought 100 microseconds per mile of fiber is huge, but you're saying it's not that much.
It's not much because today's applications don't need that low latency, right?
I don't know.
I mean, maybe they do, but no one really is complaining about it yet. But there are some people who are, right? I think there was one HotOS paper that started talking about that.
Network latency.
Yeah, network latency.
The argument is that network latency hasn't gone down.
Yeah, and I think their argument was mostly about multi-tier applications where hopping, you have multiple servers, maybe a web server and then the database server and the storage server, and just the latencies for communicating across the network for these servers can be a substantial fraction of the overall end-to-end latency.
True, right? Can increase, but latency is just speed of light. It won't get lower than 100 microseconds. So
I think that you need caching.
The future is caching. Lots and lots of caching.
Yeah, but that costs a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But they are the only way of reducing latency.
I'm not sure.
Well, the question is, how much are you willing to pay for a lower latency, and who is paying for it?
Well, if there is a requirement.
The people who are using Google are not paying for it. Well, they're paying indirectly using, by looking at ads, but it's very hard to get people to pay for that kind of latency, right? Because you're talking about putting a Fusion IO device, I don't know how big,
each server.
That's a lot. And at least in the short term, it's hard for that to happen.
Okay.
And it's not going to be universal. There may be a case for it for specific applications. But it's just not affordable.
Just to have an idea, what's the latency of web access request, more or less? That's in the order of seconds, milliseconds,
milliseconds, less than a second.
Like a web access, that's the only thing latency.
For instance, here in India, I think that is like 300 milliseconds.
1/10 of a second is still acceptable, right, for access to Google. If I type google.com and it comes back to me in 1/10 of a second, I'm pretty happy.
So that's
now, do I need
100 milliseconds.
100 milliseconds. Do I need 100 microseconds? I probably won't notice the difference, right?
Oh, by the way, I was reading an article about, financial transactions in New York and stuff like that. That's in the order of microseconds.
Yeah. Well, there it makes
sense. They need low latency, I guess.
Because
they're plugged in, like, directly next to the building.
Yeah, they're plugged in, yeah.
So that way they have to be first to reduce latency.
Yes.
And then there's a giant cable between
the problem is that because, I mean, the guys who are, you know,
Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, yeah, the big financial institutions, they get information microseconds before other people see the same information. So they have that advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They have that advantage in in making trades. So before you see that, you know, Apple dropped by $10 because Steve Jobs is, before you see that, they see it like 10 microseconds before you,
yeah.
Right? And they can make the trade before you and be ahead of you.
So that goes with my point. Right?
Yeah, for them, yes. No, you can put Fusion IO as many as you want in those in those servers.
But everybody can see 10 microseconds faster than our people.
So they can...
No, but they have
software.
Yeah, computers doing automatic trades. Yeah.
They can also pay Walter Mercado.
Oh, yeah.
I paid before.
Yeah. They would know.
Okay, so, yeah, we have... So anyway, what I wanted to say is that at least Ajay and I, we thought that there was a good idea for a startup company, and based on what, you know, I don't know, you guys have some experience with VMware. At least both Irfan and Ajay think that it's actually a pretty cool thing to have, and VMware and virtualized environments can benefit substantially from something like this.
And what would EMC say about it?
They don't need to say anything, right? See, EMC anyway builds its business around acquisitions, right? So other people build businesses, develop their ideas, and EMC goes out and buys them, right? So
a lot of companies do
they don't waste their time developing new technology.
Data
they just go and buy them.
They bought Data Domain. They also bought. Right?
Yeah,
they bought.
It's cheaper that way, right?
Yeah, much cheaper. I mean,
well,
because
I was reading there's this very interesting presentation that a guy did at Google about why businesses do that. And they say, well, first thing is that big businesses are very bureaucratic. So just to get the idea developed will take them probably more time. The other reason is IP, right? So if you have more IP, then you have more probability of being acquired.
What's
IP?
Patents. Intellectual property.
Right, so you have more probability of being acquired by someone.
Yeah.
Because that costs them a lot of, because you cannot patent the same thing twice.
Right.
Ideally.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why you asked. Who asked about EMC, by the way? You asked me?
I asked
you. Yeah, so I don't know why that question came up, but if you, I mean, can you explain why you asked that question?
Because that will be a direct competitor for EMC.
So what?
EMC.
So what?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's BMFS.
Isn't like Ajay going to his house and building a new hypervisor?
No.
Well, first of all, if we go the startup route, very likely Ajay would have to quit VMware to do this, because it's a conflict of interest anyway.
No, but I don't think it's necessary. Well, I know people in IBM who have startups, and then IBM likes startups.
No, at least he told me that it's for him it's not possible in VMware.
And you, another question is that you're sure that this can only be solved at the storage side alone, right? Not collaboration with hypervisor.
You could, but you need something in the storage.
Yeah, probably if you have collaboration, it's always better, right?
Yeah. Because I'm thinking, wouldn't it be better to extend the protocols and do everything at the hypervisor?
No, hypervisor always does that. You remember the load balancer part?
What I'm saying. It's already doing it.
They take information from the storage, and they take information from the hypervisors or the VMs, and based on the run queue and whatever, and they automatically control.
Well,
there's no guarantee.
The main problem of doing things at the hypervisor, or only at the hypervisor, or mostly at the hypervisor, is because the hypervisor does not have knowledge about the data itself and where data is, right? For the hypervisor to know that kind of knowledge is just too much information, right? And the other thing, if the product something like this exists, it is most likely would be a NAS appliance, like a file server, right? Instead of a block server.
And also many hypervisors share the same box.
Right.
So you have limited control of the box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could talk about having the hypervisors communicate with each other, but then there's additional communication and latency because of that and delays. So I think the basic building block needs to be there inside the storage server because it has access to data, right? It knows that, okay, if I put this block of data on an SSD, I get a certain response time for access to that block, right? So it there could be communication, but that at a much higher level, right? The more basic level, you need to build a storage box that's capable of guaranteeing something.
Well, you still need to extend the protocol, the block layer. Ah, well, you're saying it's foul. Yeah,
the reason it's NAS is because people expect these days storage servers to do lots of things, right? They want to do remote mirroring, backup, snapshotting, deduplication, compression, right? If you want to build a block device that does all that, it's a lot of work.
Oh, but even a NAS can export a SAN architecture if you want.
Yeah, if you want, you can make the NAS guy export SAN, right? So, but there are all these systems that already implement these capabilities. So one of the things we talked about is that it would make much more sense to build this on top of ZFS, which already does a lot of these things and utilize capabilities from ZFS directly than have to build all the other basic capabilities.
I have one more question. So latency reservations will be per file operations now?
Per VMDK.
But
per virtual disk.
No, but the operations would be, let's say you have a big read, small read, the latency reservation is for the whole read operation.
Yeah, but that's something you can decide, right? That's something you can, is part of the protocol itself or part of the SLO specification to say, okay, I guarantee 50 millisecond latency for 64K reads as long as you're within 1,000 IOPS, right?
Okay.
So something like that. So if you're doing 64 megabytes, then I count it as 1,000 operations instead of a single one. So then I have the flexibility to delay the completion by a factor of 1,000. Okay. So, but these are all things that you can decide later on, depending on what you want to support. But there needs to be some basic support in there, right? And it's not an easy, because you have the capability of not just using SSDs, but now the cache partitioning issue, right? How do you partition the cache across all the virtual disks to guarantee latencies, right? That's a different goal now.
Yeah.
So, but it's the same kind of issue there. How do you, so it's not the same as maximizing throughput or hit rate of the cache.
That's the paper you sent, right? It's along those lines. You sent a paper about partitioning the cache that gives some quality service guarantee.
Right. Something along those lines. Yeah, but this is an idea that both me and Ajay are very interested in, at least exploring on the research side first. And if we get somewhere, then take the next step. So if you're interested, come and talk to me.
Yeah, we already talked about
that. We talked briefly, yeah. And I think this can be a fairly substantial project, so, we can always have more people.
Could you get funding for that? I mean, funding in terms of public funding?
You mean venture funding?
No, public.
NSF funding?
NSF funding.
I think it's certainly, NSF funding certainly possible. I think this is a research problem, so we should be able to get something.
And then from that NSF funding, could you start up?
Yeah. Well, NSF funds startups, right?
Oh, okay.
NSF has this SBIR program, Small Business Innovations Research, and they have stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3. In stage 1, your goal is to go and get external funding. So they are funding the process of you going and getting venture funding. And there is stage 2 and stage 3. If stage 1 doesn't work out, they support in stage 2 depending on what your progress has been. So there are a lot of companies. For instance, YY's company, she has a company called Pattern Insight. I don't know how successful it is, but it was funded through NSF, SBI. But we could also choose not to do NSF because it's very competitive. I'm told it's easier to get money from venture capitalists than to get from NSF. But you also give up a fraction of your company. That's the only downside.
So stock options.
And NSF doesn't want anything. Anyway, I think...
you can go to Louis again, right?
Yeah, we have like 5 minutes. So Louis, go for it.
Okay. Well, the idea is, okay, so in rate systems, usually reconstruction or even writing, you know, that when you write, you also have to update the parity. I think that could, all, at least those two operations can be substantially alleviated if you have information of what blocks are used and which ones are not. For instance, in the case of the reconstruction, if you know that the whole row of blocks are not used, then you don't need to reconstruct anything, right? But you just forget about that and continue forward. In the case of writing, for instance, you can calculate two parities, I mean, the parities of two blocks, for instance.
The ones that have the...
The ones that have it, yeah. And the other one, you can ignore if you want. And probably there are some other optimizations that you can do if you have that information. Now, the problem with that is that if you have having a bitmap, let's say, specifying which blocks are used or which one are not, it's usually very big, right? So it can occupy a lot of space. So I was thinking of using a more probabilistic probabilistic data structure, like a Bloom filter, and out of which you can say which blocks are not used for sure, and probably you will have some that, you know, false positive.
The right? Problem with Bloom filtering is that aging will become complicated, because with a Bloom filter you cannot delete anything. So as the rate ages, you will always get positive.
That's true. That's true. But then the question is, are there any other data structure, like a Bloom filter or something?
But even, I mean, talking apart from the data structure, you can use some data structure to figure out
exactly
what is live or dead. Mm-hmm. But the first question is, how do you figure out if you don't have that bitmap? And if you just have a SAN device, that you don't see what is being used or not, right?
That's true, but if you have a SAN device, then the RAID is controlled in the SAN device box itself. Mm-hmm. So,
but how do you know which is, where is the, what, you don't have access to the bitmap.
Oh, I see. You mean, how do you know
what
blocks are used by the well,
you get trim commands.
I was thinking that when you have, you can get string commands like in the SSC, and when you start, you are assuming that no block is used, right?
Yeah, but I guess what you're saying is more applicable to a mass appliance where the file system is co-located. Something like Solaris, where you control all the entire stack and so on.
Yeah, CFS already does that, and actually it doesn't reconstruct blocks that are not used.
Right.
Yeah. But I was thinking more on the block level side.
Then the block level side, the problem is how do you know what needs to be constructed?
Okay. Yeah. I guess the trim will be an easy solution for that.
And also, I think Ramsey's group at Wisconsin, they had a couple of papers in 2000, early 2000. One was life or death at block level, where their goal was to extract whether a block is used or not at the block level.
Okay.
And then there was another paper that they wrote called Degrade, where the idea of building a RAID system where even if you lose one disk, you do not lose all your data. You preserve some part of your file system.
Okay.
So those are the related works in this case.
Okay.
So Degrade and life or death, those are the two. Okay, so I guess we should stop. This was very productive, I think. Yeah.
One short one?
Short one, yes.
Okay. Well, actually, I'm not sure if that's the way it happens, but I would know anyways. I would like to know. If you have a couple of writes to the file system, to the block layer, and you want to order these writes, what you would usually do is you send one, wait for completion, and send the next one. And that's all that's all POSIX can provide, right? But by doing that, you're losing some parallelism from the device, because you could send a bunch of IOs with some order predefined.
Who send those IOs? The application or
whoever?
OS. Okay.
Yeah. And by sending this bunch of files with some order predefined, you could get more parallelism, more throughput. And that's basically the question I have. I mean, is there something in that matter? Who could maintain
patches.
That order? Patches.
The patches work from UCLA, right?
No, but they don't do that.
But I mean, don't you have like command queuing and all that sort of things?
But that doesn't maintain order.
What guarantee. I think what he wants is guaranteeing order.
Yeah.
Oh,
very important. I think it's important for consistency.
I think the patches work better.
Yeah.
But I think it's waiting for completion. Because the devices doesn't provide you the way of sending a lot of
I see what you mean. So yeah. What you want is that in the command queuing, you want some tag saying this one comes.
Yeah, exactly. Don't reorder.
The patches work, and they allow the parallel issuing of unrelated requests.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right? So that's the novelty there. But in the path of requests that are related, they wait for the completion.
So I think there is a lot of ways at that point. And my question is the hardware the only place where you can fix it? Maybe you can do something at the software layer. I don't know.
So what you're talking about is I/O transactions, right? So there is this, the other work that I can think of now is Franz Kaschewick's work from long time back. It's called Logical Disk. Logical Disk. It's 1998 or something like that. Yeah. So Logical Disk does the disk level transactions of a set of IOs. But there it's not dependency. It's saying, okay, either all these IOs complete or none of them do.
But with that you can...
But at the software level. But yeah.
No, with that we cannot implement all.
No, you cannot. But yeah. Something to look at for you.
Okay.
Maybe there are some ideas there.
One question. You issue all the IO operations and the device give an answer for each one.
Yes.
So, right?
Independently.
So you just keep issuing other operations until the one that you want before.
I guess that's how way of doing it. You can get the order the device made after completion of all the ones, and if the order is not the one you wanted, maybe you can reset.
No.
That's what you're saying?
What I'm saying
no,
is...
No, but that doesn't make any sense. If,
yeah.
If
yeah.
they all
if
got
you
done...
Crash,
yeah. What I'm saying is that if you want parallelism, as you receive more I operation, you just keep sending those until the one that you need before reply and then send the other one.
What he's saying is what happened is... If all IOs depend on each other, I mean, you don't have a chance for parallelism.
Has some strict order,
right?
And he has
but then, what are you proposing is that sending that information to the device,
and
say, okay, all these are a chain of IOs, so
it would be like a giant transaction.
And all of them at the same time, and doing it this order.
That sounds like a logical disk question. That it addresses.
You can. I guess you can ask for the device to avoid reordering, right?
No, you cannot
disable that.
No.
So you can disable write buffering. That's what you can do.
But
that doesn't guarantee you no reordering. That just says
the whole point of having several requests on the device is for the device to reorder them, so you can have a better throughput.
Yeah, but I guess a simple solution is just having some way to disable sending whatever you want
that would be the simplest.
But then it's the same as having in the queue in the operating system.
Yeah.
And that came from there is a point during Solid Remotion where they have to order all the requests with OIO one to implement ordering, and then OIO goes down, and that's like a bottleneck in the middle of the remotion. And I was thinking, I mean, couldn't you be doing something
better?
Yeah.
You need cooperation from the disk, I think.
Yeah.
But look at the logical disk version.
Okay.
Okay, so we should stop here.
Okay.